My name is Ana Mandagoitia. I have a question about the beginning of the lecture. I believe you said that every... Sorry?
No, I'm sorry.
that every civil war was then aiming for democracy. And I was...
No.
Or that every movement was... liberating movement was aiming for democracy.
Go ahead.
And I was wondering if democracy is not imposed by the West or by the European or American culture to other cultures who are... Maybe democracy won't work and is not the ethical solution, as I think you also said.
Okay. I didn't mean to say that democracy causes civil war. What has happened often is that movements toward democracy have generated or have started civil wars, and that when that civil war becomes a serious conflict, it makes it almost impossible then for a democracy to be established. And I think what has happened in the last 20 years as the United States has tried to export democracy to other nations has shown that very clearly, that what we have succeeded in doing is destroying other regimes without being able to create a democracy. Because democracy, as I see it, necessarily grows from experience with conflict and with compromise that is resolved through political means. And in many cultures in the world, that's not how conflicts have been resolved. That's not how people want to resolve conflict. So I think it is certainly true that democracy is not appropriate for every regime or for every culture at every time in every place. I'm not trying to offer a theory of democracy. I'm trying to offer a history of democracy in the Atlantic world from the 16th century through to the end of the 19th century. And in those circumstances, I think I can show the effect that civil wars or wars of religion have had that have made it more difficult for democracy to be planted. But the point you make about the way in which the United States has tried to export democracy is exactly right. Occasionally it has worked. More often than not, it has failed.
Yes, please have the microphone down. Over here, please. Second row.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I would like to express my thanks very briefly, but very deeply felt, I must say. I would like to thank Professor Schwartz and Frau Dekanin Theuner, and also the three organizers, annual organizers of these lectures, Birgit Balzar and Margarete Gramm and Thomas Anger. I'm really deeply grateful to all of you who make this by now really annual event possible with really, I think, considerable, almost considerable difficulties. And of course, I'm all the happier that these difficulties so far have been overcome every time. Now, also, of course, my thanks to Professor Kloppenberg. I was very, very happy indeed when you started your lecture with Ranke's lectures to the Bavarian king, because in my own lectures in this very room, I very often have begun lectures on American history with exactly the same quotation and Ranke's reference to the breakthrough of the notion of popular sovereignty in the American Revolution. So these words are, Ranke's words are familiar to me and have been pronounced here quite often. Now, I would like to refer perhaps to two points which have struck me particularly. You said that the American federal constitution really has been a democratic achievement in spite of what various critics have said in the past. Now, in a way, I would certainly agree. And I have brought along, because I've been impressed by it for a long time, notes that Alexander Hamilton jotted down prior to a speech he gave in July of 1788 to the ratifying convention in New York, defending the work, the achievement of the draft of the federal constitution. And there we see Hamilton really thinking very much in the terms of traditional political theory. He said, I will be brief, he said, again, great confusion about the words democracy, aristocracy, monarchy. Democracy defined by some, Rousseau, etc. So he also referred to Rousseau, a government exercised by the collective body of the people, etc., etc. And then he concluded that democracy, I quote, democracy in my sense is where the whole power of the government is in the people, one, whether exercised by themselves, or two, by their representatives chosen by them either immediately or immediately and legally accountable to them. Consequence, the proposed government for the United States, the proposed government, a representative democracy. And as far as I've seen, Hamilton seems to be seemed to have been one of the first persons who spoke of representative democracy in these now very modern words, but which were at that time still rather rare, I think. Used it 10 years earlier too, calling the Constitution of New York State a representative democracy. And he said that this representative democracy, as far as is consistent with the genius, has all the features of good government. These features, one, an immediate and operative representation of the people, which is found in the House of Representatives, stability and wisdom, which is found in the Senate, a vigorous executive, which is found in the President, an independent judicial, which is found in the Supreme Court. So all this under the heading of representative democracy. But, I would argue that Hamilton and others were, without perhaps reflecting too much about it, still caught in the tradition of democracy, aristocracy, monarchy, as it had come down from the political thought of antiquity. Because if he speaks, and if the Constitution began with the words, we the people, as we all know, of course, slaves were left out, as they were left out in ancient Athens. I have wondered, and I wonder until today, how openly and apparently without reflection various very distinguished persons, including Tocqueville, used the word democracy while slavery was existent, at least in large parts of the United States and elsewhere. And I've always, and also I must add, the word democracy has been used apparently without any further reflection for periods when women were denied the vote, when half of the adult population did not have a vote. I felt and feel that really one ought to be more careful and should perhaps speak of partial democracy, partielle Demokratie, and Teildemokratie, as long as important parts of the population of a country really were left out. So, in a way, the early United States, I mean, these changes with the abolitionists and the changes with Lincoln and later, were really caught in the ancient tradition of political thought, democracy, but slavery is taken as a self-evident possible part of democracy. My second and last point, somewhat related to it, is the following. Jefferson, in his very famous first inaugural as President of the United States, said, of course, that we are all Democrats, we are all Republicans, and he tried to reconcile the differences which and into which I will not go now, which had broken up between Democrats and Republicans. I mean, we know all about that. So he said, rightly so, I would say, we're all Republicans, we're all Democrats. And then he ended his, well, not he didn't end, but he concluded, I quote from memory, so it's not completely literally, but I think I quote fairly correctly. He said, though the will of the majority is in all cases to prevail, that will to be rightful must respect the equal rights of a minority, which equal laws must protect. His emphasis is on equal rights to be protected by equal laws of the minority. So the will of the majority really is relative to respect for the rights of the minority. And of course that is, that continues to be one of the greatest and maybe insoluble problems of democratic government. And of course the tragic irony, if you wish, is the fact that the representatives, the most thoughtful representatives of Southern slavery, like Calhoun, did develop a theory of minority protection under the title of concurrent majority. The theory of concurrent majority is really a theory of the veto right of a minority, of a large minority. And the interesting thing is that a very distinguished European, Austrian, German legal scholar, Georg Jelinek, trying to protect minority rights of the German population in the Austro-Hungarian monarchy, in the Austrian part of it, referred to John Calhoun as one of the master theorists of minority rights. Mm-hmm. Tragic irony.
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously those are both very valuable and important observations. I would certainly not contend that the United States today or that any other nation is a complete democracy. I think we have never had the experience of anything except a partial democracy, because I think it is the very nature of democracy to extend ideals that can then never be reached. And if the United States ever solves the problem of growing economic inequality, then there will be another form of exclusion that will be generated. As it is now, we tend not, we've now included African Americans and women as full citizens, but immigrants are still largely shut out from the rights of citizens in the United States. Millions of people who live their entire lives in the United States do not have the rights of citizens. The United States has the largest number of people in prison of any nation in the world as a percentage of its population, and those people are denied their legal rights because they are or have been incarcerated. So my feeling is that we have to admit from our perspective that the 18th century achievement of a democratic nation was deeply flawed. It was, as you say, only a partial democracy. My point is that within the standards of the 18th century, it was the most democratic nation the world had seen, and that the extension of civic rights to African Americans, to women, eventually, I think, to immigrants, is possible without a fundamental transformation of the Constitution. The Constitution itself has the resources to enable the further expansion, and I would argue has the resources to enable the further expansion to a social democracy, as well as simply a political democracy. That is the pattern that the generation of thinkers and political activists that I wrote about in Uncertain Victory thought they could see on the horizon. They thought it was just a matter of time before the United States embraced a fully robust welfare state that would provide a floor beneath which people could not fall, so that everyone would be able to take advantage of the opportunity to make the most of his or her life. It hasn't turned out that way. When I finished that book, I thought about writing a history of social democracy that would come forward from 1920 up to the present. And one of the reasons I'm sorry I did not do that is that this one that I've just finished ended up being much more complicated and much more difficult and taking me all the way back to the ancient world. But also, it made it impossible for me to use the obvious title for the successor volume to this, which would have been Certain Defeat, Social Democracy, 1920 to the Present. I think it is simply the case that as our conception of what a full democracy would include continues to expand and to become more ambitious, more all-inclusive, we'll continue to generate other forms of conflict that will make it very difficult to reach those goals. I think that's simply the nature of democracy. As I argued at the beginning, these are conflicts that cannot, even in principle, fully be resolved. So I agree with you entirely. It was, at best, a partial democracy. As for the rights of minorities, I think that was the biggest challenge facing Abraham Lincoln and the Union when the Civil War decided to secede. Many people in the northern states thought that the South should simply be allowed to go. If the southern states wanted to preserve slavery, why not let them go? Many northerners thought that slavery had been America's original sin and that the preservation of slavery had prevented the United States from becoming the kind of democracy that it should have become. Professor Sturz, in one of his essays, cites the Quok Walker case in the late 18th century in Massachusetts, in which the settlement essentially laid out the principles. This is in the 1780s, the principles of the full humanity and thus the rights of African Americans and the unconstitutionality of the institution of slavery. It took more than half a century for that to become a general conviction on the part of more Americans. But the problem, I think, with Calhoun's theory is that it was quite clearly designed only to protect the institution of slavery. As a theory for the protection of multiple minorities, of the sort that you have in Austria and other German-speaking nations, it has resources that are very interesting and very valuable. So I'm not surprised to hear that Jelinek would invoke Calhoun. But it was apparent to Americans in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, that the only purpose that this theory served was to defend the institution of slavery. And to an increasingly large number of Americans, the institution of slavery came to seem the opposite of the democratic principle. So the genius of Lincoln's speeches in the Civil War, actually from the 1850s, from his Peoria address through his speeches during the Civil War, was to enshrine the principle of equality as the central principle of American democracy. That American democracy was not simply about individual rights. It was about equality just as much as it was about individual rights. It was about equal rights. Now, there have been a number of books arguing that this is Lincoln's creation, that Lincoln changes the American political tradition by manipulating the resources of the 18th century in order to make it appear that equality was important in America. I think that's a mistake. Tocqueville came to America in 1830, and he already saw that equality was the defining feature of American democracy. The passage that you quote and that I read from Benjamin Franklin also indicates that Americans in the 1770s were committed to breaking down, to destroying a culture of hierarchy, a culture in which there were levels beyond which an individual could not aspire because you were limited to your status in a particular place in the hierarchy. John Adams hated that with a passion. Benjamin Franklin hated it with a passion. That was what made them committed to democracy. So I think you're right that the question of how you reconcile the legitimate rights of minorities with majority rule remains a perennial challenge within a democracy. But as Jefferson understood, the majority must rule or else the nation dissolves. And that was Lincoln's response to the South when the South seceded. If it is legitimate, if it is legal for you to withdraw when you lose an election, then the next time there's an election in any one of your states, the counties or the towns that feel they have been mistreated will withdraw from your state. And then another community will withdraw from the town, and you'll find yourselves immediately in anarchy. There has to be a way for minorities and majorities to debate their differences and come to a political solution, or else you have civil war. And what saddens me about the contemporary condition of American politics is that one of our major parties seems to be committed to the proposition that it will compromise on no issues with the party in power, that it will simply oppose everything proposed by Barack Obama and the Democratic Party. If we continue down that path, we cannot be a functioning democracy. And it's deeply troubling to me that this has happened in measurable ways, the most serious partisan division in American history since the Civil War, at the time that we have our first African-American president. It seems to me deeply troubling that it is this moment that the Republican Party has chosen to take an absolutely obstructionist stand against anything the Democratic Party proposes. But I agree with both of the points you make, that partial democracy is all the United States had in the 18th century. It's all we have in the 21st century. And I agree that defending the legitimate rights of minorities is one of the most difficult things that any democracy has to do.
Professor Buch.
Philippe Buch, Institut für Geschichte. I've really enjoyed this talk because it's brought into my mind a number, or maybe just one big question of comparative history. So if we start with the French Revolution, I would agree with you, and it's a long tradition since Hans Bloch to look at it as a fundamentally Christian event. If one looks at the energies of the French Revolution, they're deeply para-religious. One sees also very much the unwillingness to compromise in the revolutionaries. Marat, when he describes the assembly, cannot see dialogue there. He sees only chattering, anger. He does not want to understand that there might be negotiation in the assembly. And Jean-Clément Martin has described very well how all the fracture lines of the Ancien Régime that existed throughout France that were kept in equilibrium by mediation form are destroyed completely by the ideology, by the fact that it's religious. Of course, one can debate what was really the deep flaw of the revolution that led to the terror, whether it was this absence of culture or the utopian nature of French Revolution or sheer military pressure, and French historians debate that and will debate that endlessly because there are issues of chronology and perception. So now if we turn to America, we turn to the two wars that you mentioned, the French like to call the War of Independence because they don't like to call the American Revolution a revolution, and the War of Secession, as the French would call it, so the U.S. Civil War. Despite Bailyn, it is clear that there are also religious energies and sermons, and very much in the Civil War, religious forces and religious drumming for it. What is remarkable is how quickly afterwards things are healed, at least on the surface. I mean, you presented a very dark image of the aftermath of the Civil War as creating deep ruptures, but on the surface of political culture, it was rather nice. If you think of the Civil War with so many people killed, there was no purge after the U.S. Civil War. So one question is how to account for this. Does it have something to do with a culture of negotiation that already existed? Did the Americans have the ability to re-heal the wounds of Civil War more quickly? And the other question that I have is, how were the religious energies of the 70s that actually saw the English regime as Antichrist brought to the New World, or the fanaticism, as it was called back then, of the abolitionists, how were these processed by these cultures? So one can look at how in the French Revolution the normal mechanism of conflict resolution are destroyed locally. One can look at that and one can trace that, how they're destroyed by revolutionary ideology or counter-revolutionary ideology or factions. But how does that work during the American Revolution itself, that these very strong statements by preachers who also speak of traitors and all of that, or the similar statements in the Civil War, how does that get evacuated? How does that evaporate? It seems to evaporate.
Well, There are two different dynamics, I think, at work. First, in the War for American Independence, one of the great differences between that war and the French Revolution is that the loyalists, or the Tories, as they're called, leave after the revolution, and they don't come back. I mean, in France, not only do they come back into power, so that the Civil War is continuous, and those social orders that had broken down are reinforced and replanted, if you will, in this very unsettled terrain. In America, once the loyalists leave, it's over, essentially. There's no more resistance to the new nation. Robert Palmer, in his great book, The Age of Democratic Revolutions, points out that one could argue that the dislocation of persons and the amount of property seized was as great in the American Revolution as it was in the French Revolution. So the actual upheaval, the actual disruption during the American Revolution was almost as great as it was during the French Revolution. The difference is that it's a permanent disruption in America. And in the aftermath of the revolution, for example, primogeniture, the law that estates must pass down undivided to the oldest son, is ended throughout the United States. So you have a regime, a law of partible inheritance, which means that there's no opportunity for even a de facto aristocracy to grow in America. You have, I mean, Thomas Jefferson's own estate is broken up. His family is impoverished after his death. John Adams is the son of a shoemaker who becomes president of the United States, and there's not a vast family fortune in the Adams family. If any of you ever go to the United States and want to visit a fascinating piece of American history, the home where John Adams was born and raised still exists. It's about as big as this stage. That was the foundation of this great family dynasty. It's a family dynasty not of wealth, but of intelligence and of political action. So the difference is, this part of the revolution is complete in the sense that a society of hierarchy is dismantled and is never put back together. Many Anglicans who were most attached to England leave as the Loyalists leave, and even though the Anglican Church persists in America after the Revolution, there never was an established Anglican Church outside a few states in the southern tier of the colonies, and that established church ends. That's part of what Jefferson and Madison accomplish in Virginia. They oppose the state authorization of the Anglican Church. So there are multiple religious denominations in most of the states after the revolution, and that too contributes to this boisterous competition among different groups, but no single group can dominate or silence the other groups. The minorities do, as Jefferson said, have their rightful place as religious groups as well as social and political groups. Now, as for the Civil War, I think the explanation for why there is apparent peace after the Civil War is very simple. It's as simple as a single word, and that word is racism. Americans, North and South, white Americans, North and South, agreed within a decade after the end of the Civil War that African Americans were simply not worthy of citizenship, and that it was not worth the trouble of the North to try to impose the rule of law or to guarantee the rights of African Americans that had supposedly been enshrined by the 14th and 15th Amendment, two amendments of the Constitution after the amendment that ended slavery. There were two more amendments that supposedly secured the legal rights of African Americans and secured the voting rights of African Americans. But after the election of 1876, the Republican Party agreed with the South, essentially, to withdraw the military from the South and to allow the South to govern itself. And once that decision was made, it was a very simple matter for white supremacy to be put back in place in the South. And during the 1890s and the first decade of the 20th century, an amazingly elaborate set of laws was put in place, fully legal by white legislatures, that subjected African Americans to essentially a form of oppression almost as complete as slavery. Now, not all American historians agree with that analysis, but I think the very best book that has been written about the cultural consequences of the Civil War is a book by a man named David Blight, and it's a book called Race and Reunion. And he goes through the particular legal and cultural stages by which Northerners essentially withdrew from the crusade that had ended slavery and slipped backed into a kind of racial supremacy that meant there was no need any longer for any conflict. The great African American historian and sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois has a chapter in his book called The Souls of Black Folk. It's a chapter called The Sons of Master and Man. And in that brilliant chapter, he points out what would have been necessary in order for democracy to work in the aftermath of the Civil War. You had one group of people, as he points out, who had lived their entire lives as masters. And they were now told, you're no longer masters, you're equal to the people who had been your slaves. You had another group who had lived their entire lives as slaves. And they were now told, without having been given education, without having had access to property, without being able to support themselves, you are now equal to these people who had been your masters. Du Bois's point is that there was absolutely no way that that was going to work in the space of a decade. There was no way that the former slaves were prepared to be citizens. There was no way that the masters were prepared to accept their former slaves as their equals. So from Du Bois's point of view, this was a tragic but an unavoidable outcome that was the long-term consequence of slavery. So as much as Du Bois hated the perpetuation of racial segregation and oppression, he could not see an immediate alternative. As far as he was concerned, it would take decades of work to transform the economy, to transform the politics, to transform the attitudes of both African Americans and whites in the South in order for equality even to be imaginable. And one can argue that that's what the struggle for civil rights, which actually starts in the 1930s and continues until today, has been all about, transforming those attitudes. And all you have to do is look at the language of many far-right American politicians and newspapers today to see that we still haven't gotten close to it. The degree of hate, the degree of refusal to acknowledge the humanity of African Americans is almost as bitter today as it was 100 years ago.
I've noted two more questions. Maybe I can ask you to be a bit brief, if possible. You have the microphone still? Please, here. Botschafter von Norden.
And I will try to be more brief in my answers. I apologize.
Sometimes you have to be a bit late. I just wanted to say that I completely share your deeply troubling analysis of the present political situation that we are facing in the United States, and a situation which is troubling for us in Europe as well, and for all the people who sort of are formed or connected to the United States. Everybody is very worried about how this is going to play out. But I wanted to introduce another issue, a phenomenon with which we are dealing today, really. And it seems to me that one of the big questions that we have today is that we are faced with a democratic process that may, in many cases, lead to undemocratic results. And that what you have described sort of with Ranke's word as the right of nations to govern themselves does not necessarily always lead to democratic results on the ethical basis that you have so aptly described, may lead to very flawed circumstances, may lead to very authoritarian circumstances, And you don't have to go far. We see some of these issues in Europe. We see it in the Middle East, in many other cases. And then the second thing which I find very troubling is what Colin Crouch called the post-democracy phenomenon, that you have in many cases democratic institutions, but they are only the trappings of democracy, but that they are devoid of sort of the real content that we would define as a democratic rule. And I would like to know what you are thinking about.
Well, that's actually the reason why I place so much emphasis on these cultural dimensions of democracy, because I think if you simply take the institution of majority rule or the institution of the rule of law and you try to place that in a culture filled with hate and filled with great differences of conviction on basic fundamental issues, you're going to have war. I mean, being willing to let your enemy win an election is a very rare phenomenon in human history. Usually, when your enemy wins, you mobilize your army to go to war against your enemy. And democracy demands that you not do that, that you say, well, we have to work harder in the next election so that we can win. That's a very difficult thing for people to accept. So I agree with you entirely that in the absence of what I call an ethic of reciprocity, one's hatred dominates one's willingness to participate in the process, and the entire fabric comes apart. So I think this is, I mean, basically, you've stated better than I did in my presentation the reason why I think this analysis is so important. That democracy has to be understood as a deep cultural and ethical project rather than simply a set of institutions. And if you don't have those cultural underpinnings, the institutions are simply not strong enough to prevent the culture from coming apart. And I think too often people assume that if you have the institutions, that's all you need. Everything else will take care of itself. And the opposite is true. If you have the institution without the underlying values, the institutions are almost worthless, because you can have one group of people, any majority of two, capable of enslaving the minority of one. And we've seen that again and again and again in human history, that majorities do believe that because they won, the other group has no rights. And we've seen minorities who say because the majority won, we have to either secede or go to war. So I agree with you entirely. It's a much more difficult cultural project to create a democratic culture than it is to paste democratic institutions on a culture that is not committed to the principles of democracy. It's even darker than we thought.
The final question, gentleman up there, please.
Thank you. I'm Helmut Forst. My background is economics, so I'll really be very brief and simple, I guess, to the point of rescue simplicity, but I may be forgiven because of my background in the history session. Thank you very much for your lecture. There's little to add to this. To these things. I'd like to continue from your conclusion that we can still see in the United States the legacy of the Civil War, intellectual legacy of the Civil War, cultural legacy of the Civil War, in today's political democratic debates and life. One of the problems, if I read Joseph Stiglitz correctly, of course, one of the major problems of Western democracies is inequality, is economic inequality. And Stiglitz ventures the hypothesis that in the U.S. at least, the glaring inequalities may engender political inequality as well, because I think he claims that not enough is done to make the democratic system resilient to the danger of this spillover, as we would say in economics. My question is this endemic problem of inequality, which economic theory and political theory and political philosophy, John Rawls, for example, have very very lucidly outlined and proposed suggested solutions to. For the historical account of inequality, can we see in the history of American democracy, for example, the intellectual history germs of today's inability of the system to deal with this with the nexus of economic inequality and political inequality? If Stiglitz is right. Thank you.
It's a very good question, and first, let me say thank you for the question. Whenever in the American context now, whenever anyone identifies himself or herself as a member of an economics department, one worries that the question is going to be about whether it shouldn't it just all be about markets. If we let self-interested individuals operate in the marketplace, won't everything be fine? And from a historical point of view, the answer is always, well, no. So your question comes from a very different place, and I'm grateful to you for that. I admire Joseph Stiglitz very much, and I think he is one of the few economists in the United States who is willing to acknowledge the failure of market solutions since 1980. We really have seen a renunciation of an entire regime of governance in the United States that ran from 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt was first elected, all the way to 1980. And it was a regime of governance much more similar to the social democratic governments of Northern Europe than anything we've seen since 1980. Some of you already know, I'm sure, that the curve of income tax rates in the United States was almost as steep in the 1960s and 1970s as it is in most European nations to this day, so that the very wealthy people in the United States were paying over 70% of their marginal tax rate to the federal government. Now, that was the time of the greatest economic growth in American history, the same time that there was the steepest curve in the progressive or graduated income tax. Since 1980, it has become dogma among American conservatives that such taxation is counter to American principles. People have never read Benjamin Franklin or John Adams, and that it is counter to economic growth. All of the evidence is to the contrary, that from 1945 to 1973, the distance between the wealthiest Americans and the poorest Americans steadily diminished, at the same time that the growth in the gross national product was greater than it had been at any point in United States history. Those data are clear, and they're not debatable. What's happening now is that there is a fixed belief on the part of most American conservatives that those data cannot be true, because they're contrary to what they know to be true, which is that free markets and low taxes are always and everywhere better for everyone. They're much better for the wealthiest Americans. And so what we have seen is this increasing separation of the richest Americans from everyone else. We now inhabit what, in the words of a very popular book, is considered to be a winner-take-all society. If you're at the top in America, life has never been better than it is for you now. But if you're not in the top 5% in America, your buying power, your actual purchasing power, is lower now than it was in 1970. This is the first time in American history this has been true, that the average American actually enjoys decreasing standards of living for the last 30 years. Now, in order to address this problem, you would have to reinstate that social democratic sensibility that sees equality as central to the American tradition. Part of what interested me in Barack Obama and made me want to write that book reading Obama, was in his second book, a book called The Audacity of Hope. He pays very close attention to a speech that Franklin Roosevelt gave in 1944. It was his last State of the Union address. And in that, he laid out a plan for what he called the Second Bill of Rights. And that Second Bill of Rights is essentially a very elaborate social welfare state, similar to everything that exists in Europe, which he argued was going to be the redemption. It would bring to completion the American Democratic Project, because it would make possible for all citizens education, housing, job training, health care, the entire package. That was, whether stated or not, the program of the Democratic Party up through the 1970s. The reason it was never enacted is that Southern Democrats understood that if these programs were enacted, they would also extend to African Americans. And they would give African Americans a foundation of equality with white Americans that they considered to be illegitimate. So the long-term consequences of the Civil War and the reinstatement of racism prevented the coming to fruition of Roosevelt's vision of what American democracy really should mean. Now, in Obama's book, The Audacity of Hope, he spends 10 pages describing that vision of Roosevelt and arguing that that remains the unfulfilled promise of the Democratic Party in the United States in the 21st century. Even though he is a man who is committed to conciliation, he's committed to compromise, he's committed to listening to his opponents, his ambition is social democracy. And I think the reason why there has been such intense opposition from the Republican Party is not only the fact that he's African American, and not only that he represents a culture that most American conservatives hate, not to put too fine a point on it, that most conservatives hate. They understand that if the idea of equality is restored to the central place that it has had for most of American history, then that will be translated into the tax code. And businesses will be taxed again at the level at which they were taxed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Individuals will be taxed again at the level at which they were taxed in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the notion of individuals having a responsibility to the public sphere will again become part of the American creed. And they don't want to see that happen. So from my perspective, and I think from Joseph Stiglitz's perspective, the attempt to mask political decisions within an economic framework and to pretend that what are very deliberate value choices are simply the workings of a natural process of market economics, that attempt is a very carefully worked out effort ever since the late 1970s on the part of American conservatives to define America as the last bastion of free enterprise and to define every other nation in Europe as somehow inferior to the American way of life. The vision of most American Democrats from World War II on was the opposite, that what America needed to do was to catch up with the social provision that had come into being at the end of World War II in most European nations. But there has been a pitched battle being fought ever since 1945 between progressives and conservatives. What has changed in the last 10 years, I'll make this last point and then I'll be done, is that both parties used to be coalitions of people who had very different views on most political questions. The Democratic Party did include those white Southerners who were not only racists, many of them were opposed to large government. They did believe in small local government. What has happened since the Civil Rights Movement is that those Democrats in the South have left the Democratic Party and they've migrated to the Republican Party, and that the moderate Republicans in the North and especially in the upper Midwestern states, states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Minnesota, those people have left the Republican Party and have moved to the Democratic Party. So we now have a situation in which the parties are much more ideologically oriented and more consistent, internally consistent, than they have ever been in American political history. And those of us like myself who wished for a more coherent ideological politics in America have now gotten our wish, and it's not pretty. We don't like what we have. So it's easy for a historian to look at the way the parties came into being and how they existed in the 20th century and to explain why they've changed as they have changed. The question that none of us historians can answer is, what do we need to do in order to break away from the situation we have now, in which we have these very tight ideological formations within each party, but the Congress, the most democratically elected part of the United States federal government, the Congress is much more conservative than the United States Senate, or at least for the last few elections, the presidency. So how do you reconcile your commitment to majority rule, to rule of the people, when you would like to see what I'm describing as a culture of democracy, but what we see in the vote of ordinary people for their representatives to the United States Congress? They're choosing very conservative people to represent them. So from my perspective, it requires a very deep and serious campaign on the part of people like Joseph Stiglitz and myself to try to establish that the United States actually is a culture committed to the principle of equality, and that equality is not un-American, it is the most American of political principles.